Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. And as promised, Dr. Andreas Westerle is with us again tonight to tell us what he remembers from his boyhood, when, at the age of 10, he was caught up with his extended family in the expulsion of ethnic Germans from Slovakia in 1944 and 1945. We know that Jews and supposed Holocaust victims talk a lot about how inviolate is their memory of the events they lived through during that time, although they don't show any respect for the memory of Germans for the Holocaust they went through. Tonight, we're going to honor the memory of Germans. Dr. Westerle is an expert in the political history of Europe, especially as it centers on Germany, and thus tonight, to allow his personal account to be heard at one sitting, we've extended the Heretics Hour for this one time only into a two-hour program. Dr. Westerle recorded this interview with me over a period of several days, so what you're going to hear is this conversation, mostly in the order it was spoken, but at times short segments have been inserted where they better augment the timeline and make, I hope, for an easier understanding of what is decidedly a very complex period of our common history. We begin.
Well, okay, I was born on August 30th, 1934, in Prague. And my parents came from Slovakia. When they were born, that was still part of the Kingdom of Hungary, before 1919, you know. Mm-hmm. They came from the town of Deutsch Proben. And most of the time we spent our holidays and vacations in Deutsch Proben because it was situated very beautifully, surrounded on three sides by mountains, and on the river Neusser or Nitra that flows south about 70 miles south to the Danube. But the area where my parents came from was called the Hauerland, and there were about 30 different villages and towns that were all German. And in the past, like three, 4 centuries ago, there were many, many more. But in the course of time, especially with all the wars, Turkish wars and religious wars and so on, the population of the Germans decreased and the population of the Slovaks and to some extent the Hungarians increased. So, but even so, by 1944-45, that particular region called the Hauerland still contained about 30 towns and villages that were almost exclusively German or heavily predominantly German. Deutsch Proben was founded around 1300.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get at. How long you were there? How long the Germans were there?
Yeah.
How did they get there? Why did they go there?
It's a very complicated story. Many of these towns actually were first founded in the 12th century, around 1140, 1150, 1160. And at that time, of course, they were the kings of Hungary, and they sought to fortify their borders against Poland in the north, against the nomadic peoples in the east, by strong settlers. So they called them settlers from predominantly from Germany, which at that time included the Netherlands and Belgium, and they went east in the course of the actual German eastern expansion. They went east into Thuringia and Saxony and Silesia. And from Silesia and Saxony, they went south into Hungary, including Transylvania.
Why did they want Germans to go? I mean, was that a request?
Yeah, at that time, Germany was the dominant country in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And with the possible exception of France. But France was only beginning to develop a strong monarchy. But in Western Germany, which included the Netherlands and Belgium, there had been a very strong urbanization. There was a lot of surplus population, and they were looking for places to go to, so they went east to the new lands, like Silesia and Kingdom Poland, the Kingdom of Hungary, where they founded hundreds and hundreds of new cities and villages in the 12th and 13th centuries, and later on too. And then later on, to make it more complicated, around the 14th and 15th centuries, there was a new push coming from southern Germany, including Salzburg and what is now Carinthia and Steiermark, Styria. Those are areas of present-day Austria. Mm-hmm. And those people are mainly miners. Gold miners, silver miners, and they went into northern Hungary and into Transylvania to mine gold and silver and nickel and antimon and various other chemicals.
And this was when? When was this?
This was, the miners went east around 13th, 14th centuries.
Oh, still way back.
Yeah, yeah.
So, would you say that these German people went there so long ago that aren't they as much native there as what was later called the Slavic natives? I mean, how did that work out?
Yes, of course. And not only that, but the entire area had been settled a long time ago, 2,000 years ago, by a combination of various peoples, and many of them were Germanic peoples, like the Goths and the so-called Marcomanni and the Quads and what today is Bohemia and Moravia and Slovakia. The Quads were in Slovakia. And then later on, around 200-300 AD, there was another powerful tribe that came in from northern Germany, and they settled east of Vienna in what today is northern Hungary and western Slovakia. These were the Langobards. And then in the 6th century, the Langobards were attacked by the Avars. The Avars were one of those powerful tribes of Central Asia, like the Huns and later on the Hungarians, who came in from Central Asia through Russia and Ukraine, and they pushed into Hungary and Romania, what today is Romania and Bulgaria, and they became a very powerful state. And so the Langobards in what today is Slovakia decided to move out. And they drew lots, and half of them moved into Italy in the 6th century A.D. And they conquered Italy. They conquered all of Italy except for Rome. They were afraid of the Pope because he had some kind of supernatural helpers. So they didn't want to be attacked by ghosts and demons, so they didn't attack the Pope directly, but they conquered most of Italy. And the area of northern Italy, which today is Lombardy, was named for the Langobards.
Well, that's very interesting. See, I didn't...
Yeah.
That teaches me something. So
and some of them, of course, some of them remain behind, and they still, lived down in what today is Slovakia, yeah.
Okay, so who would be the people who today consider themselves Slovakians, or since, say, the 1800s?
Yeah, well, the Slovaks are actually a combination of many ethnic factors, you know. When you look at many Slovaks today, they look Irish. So the reason they look Irish, because most of Slovakia was settled by the old Celts. First, okay. The Illyrians, or Indonesian-speaking combination, and then the Celts. And then these Celtic peoples also moved west into what today is France, and into Britain and Ireland over many, many centuries. And some of them, again, being very powerful and strong military people, they moved into Italy and then conquered Rome when Rome was still a small town. And they conquered northern Greece and all that stuff. Anyway, I don't want to take too much time about that. But anyway, the Celtic peoples, many of them still remain behind in what today is Slovakia. And then there were all these waves of new settlers, especially Germanic settlers. And then came the Avar Empire, and together with the Avars came the Slavic people.
And they when did they come?
They settled around the 6th, 7th centuries A.D.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in the course of time, all the other peoples, or maybe not all of them, but many of the peoples who had settled in Slovakia and northern Hungary became Slavicized, even though they were not Slavic originally. It's sort of like what happened in Poland, or even, say, in France, when France, today's France, when Gaul was conquered by the German tribes. Then the German tribes over the centuries became Latinized, and they started speaking some kind of strange Latin dialect. So approximately that's what happened in Slovakia and in Hungary and so on. Then, of course, in the year 893, roughly, the Hungarians came in, and then the Hungarians established their kingdom in the Kingdom of Hungary, including Slovakia and including Transylvania, and later on including Croatia and Dalmatia. So it became a very powerful empire and lasted until 1919.
All right. My goodness. All right. So your people, your ancestors, were they, you can trace back, or you think you can, or whatever, from to around the 12th century when they settled?
That's
all right. My goodness. So that was truly your people's home.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. And so what happened from your in what you remember, what you can say firsthand?
From my personal experience?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were a lot of things, of course. Then starting in the you have to go back again in history. At the end of the 18th century and then in the 19th century, there was a well-known revolution of 1848, and there was kind of a nationalistic revolution in many ways, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. And many of these emerging peoples had been influenced by great thinkers like Herder in Germany, H-E-R-D-E-R, Herder. Mm-hmm. He originally came from East Prussia, near Königsberg, and then he became an advisor to one of the dukes in Thuringia. That's where Goethe lived, at Weimar, in the famous small town in Weimar. And Herder thought that history would proceed through the mainly cooperation, sometimes conflict, but mainly cooperation and cultural and economic cooperation between the various national cultures. And he was one of the few who came up with that idea of national culture. And then there were Slovak Lutheran ministers or students who studied at the University of Vienna in central Germany near Weimar, especially people like Kolar, K-O-L-L-A-R. And then they were so struck by Herder's theories that they developed their own Slavic theories of Slavic ideology, which then later on became Pan-Slavism, you know.
Okay.
Something like Kolar thought that the Slavic countries, no matter who they were, the Slovaks or the Czechs or the Serbs and the Croatians and Bulgarians, even they're tremendously different, and the Russians, of course, they all belong to one big nation, and they all spoke one dialect of the same language, which is, of course, total nonsense. It's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that tremendous cultural difference between the Slovaks and the Czechs on one hand, and the Serbs and the Bulgarians and so on the other. Well, I don't want to go into that in too great detail. But anyway, the Pan-Slavism became very powerful in the 19th century and in the 20th century.
Okay, not until the 19th century, though. That's interesting.
Right. Well, it developed, you know, at the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
At the influence of Herder and some of the other cultural philosophers. And so since I lived in Prague, Prague was one of the centers of, well, what could you call it? Of course, there were also other people too, but very fervent Slavic insurrectionism. First, before 1919, against Austria-Hungary, and then after 1919, against everything that was non-Czech. So when the Czechs, with the aid of President Woodrow Wilson, in 1919, created their own state of Czechoslovakia, which had never existed before in the last 100,000 years.
Okay.
They established a new state, and they signed a compact here in Pittsburgh, some Slovaks and a bunch of Czechs. And the leading ideology was Slavic, or especially Czech. And it came...
Okay, and the Slovaks were kind of going along... No, the Czechs were the most powerful in this combination.
The Czechs were the most powerful ones, especially since they were favored by Woodrow Wilson. And...
Why did Woodrow Wilson favor the Czechs? Any particular reason, or just...
Well, he sort of had a very strange admiration for the Slavs. I don't know why. But also for the Poles, you know. He ordered a new Polish state which should have access to the Baltic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
That was his idea, or the idea that he got from some Polish artists and piano players, like Paderewski. And so he had all those strange ideas because he really didn't know his way around.
No, he didn't know, did he? No, he didn't know anything, but he was acting like he could make these
decisions. Yeah, he was acting as if he were the great chosen one of God, you know, the new Moses.
Yeah.
And he didn't see that all of that entire huge region was originally really a mosaic of ethnic identities and ethnic cultures and nationalities. And if you favor one or two or three of them, then the others would biologically be subjected to the others, you know, subjugated by the others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened that's how the Czechs then started to exercise their dominance, first against the Hungarians in the new Czechoslovakia, there were about a million Hungarians, against the Germans and against the Slovaks, and against the Poles, there were so several hundred thousand Poles in Slovakia, etc., etc., etc. So the whole thing came to a boil in the 1920s and 1930s, and then with the economic crisis, you know, depression, all that stuff. Everything became much worse because of the huge unemployment. And there was a lot of conflict between, on one hand, the Czechs, or especially the leaders of the Czechs, who were Masaryk, the president, and Beneš, the foreign minister, later on president. Mm-hmm. On one hand, and on the other hand, the patriotic Slovaks and the Germans and the Hungarians, which were all sort of incarcerated in this strange formation called Czechoslovakia. So then it went, you know, went on worse and worse. And then, well, of course, there was Munich in 1938, and Sudetenland was made part of Germany. And
okay,
then,
and what did the Germans, the Germans in Czechoslovakia, what did they think about that? How did they view all that?
Well, they were very, obviously, they were oppressed by the Czechs.
Mm-hmm.
They were treated, and the Germans, as well as the Slovaks, or many of the Slovaks, and the Hungarians, and the Poles, mm-hmm. and the Ukrainians in eastern Slovakia, they all regarded as undesirable minorities by the Czechs, even though the Czechs only had half of the population of Czechoslovakia.
Right, and now, and amongst the other half, the Germans were the largest
right.
of the minorities, isn't that right?
There were 3.5 million of them, right.
Okay.
And, well, then along came the European War and the Second World War, and Benesch fled to London. He established an exile government in London, and from the very start, apparently, he thought about expelling the Germans and the Hungarians, all of the Germans and all of the Hungarians, from Czechoslovakia after the end of the war. And pretty much that's what he did. And along came the famous Benesch decrees, which decreed the expulsion of the Germans and the Hungarians from Czechoslovakia.
And would you clarify for us, at the same time we had the Potsdam Agreement, he started this program of expulsion before there was any Potsdam Agreement. I mean, he did this on his own.
That's right.
Okay.
In Kaschau in eastern Slovakia, that's right.
Okay. When did he return to Czechoslovakia or whatever it was after?
Well, yeah, he returned in 1945.
Immediately.
Probably in May of 1945. But the thing is, that apparently, as far as we can tell, Benesch and some of the other leading Czech politicians and ideologists planned to expel the Germans and the Hungarians way back in 1919, mm-hmm. at the end of the First World War, you know?
Okay.
And
well,
they
but they...
They didn't get around it completely at that time. To some extent,
so were they persecuting the minorities from the end of the First World War until the beginning of the Second?
Yes, pretty
or
much.
Until the Munich Agreement?
Pretty much so. They gave the minorities, or so-called minorities, because actually they were not minorities. They made up half of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They treated them as second or third class citizens. That's right.
And as I recall, there were protests made about that. There were requests made to the victorious powers of World War One and so on, and the League of Nations and so on.
Right.
But nothing was ever done.
That's right, because the Germans, especially of the Sudetenland, the German Bohemians and Moravians and so on, they wanted to become part of Austria. And in October, November, December of 1918, you know, and later on, 1919,
mm-hmm.
and they were absolutely hindered from doing that. They were subjugated by the Czechs, and that's the way it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the French, being almost wiped out in the First World War, they established this strange small entente, or ENTE, an alliance with France on one hand, and Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia, as a sort of eastern satellites of France. and also Poland, which will be a separate entity. And this little Entente was then supposed to maintain French domination over continental Europe. Of course, it couldn't do that because it was too weak.
Mm-hmm.
And France itself was also going through all kinds of political turmoil. So all these plans really came pretty much to naught.
We'll take a break and return in a few minutes to our special extended show with Dr. Andreas Wesserle.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
It is the largest intelligence leak in U.S. history, the most revealing internal account of any war made public. We're, of course, referring to the release of 400,000 classified U.S. military documents on the Iraq War by the online whistleblower WikiLeaks. Now, the documents from 2004 to 2009 show a grim picture of the conflict, especially when it comes to the abuse of Iraqi civilians by Iraqi security forces. Now, RT actually sat down with Julian Assange this past weekend to talk about this new release. Here's part of that interview. Listen.
This is the most accurate description of a war that has ever been released into the historic record. There is nothing comparable. It is the details of the deaths of 109,000 people, the wounding of some 170,000 people, the detainment of nearly 200,000 people during a course of 6 years. And of course that is only about half the military action that went on during that period, because it's only the US view on things. But even so, extraordinary. We see that there's nearly no street corner in Baghdad that didn't have a body found that had been killed through violence in one form or another.
Now, of course, there's a wealth of important information there, but the focus of the story seems to be solely on the man at the center of all this, Julian Assange, rather than the actual substance. Now, let me answer why that might be, among other questions. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern is here. Great to see you, Ray. So, you know, when you search this story, all the top headlines read, Julian Assange walks out of, you know, CNN interview. Is Julian Assange worse than Osama bin Laden? And then only when you scroll down, you see the headline of alleged torture, rape, abuse, you know, 15,000 civilian casualties. Shouldn't those facts be at the top of the list and not the other way around?
Well, hello, of course they should.
Why aren't they?
Well, this is killing the messenger. You know, it goes back to the ancient Greek times. When you didn't like the message, you shot, you didn't shoot him, but you killed the messenger in those days. So what they're trying to do is deflect discussion of the horrid details that have come out in these documents and have an ad hominem argument against Assange to make it sort of to trivialize it and to make it sort of a personal sort of thing. The treasure trove of documents is precisely what you would expect from a war of aggression. And don't blanch before that word, because that's the way Nuremberg defined what we did in going into Iraq and Afghanistan. What Nuremberg said, and it was Justice Jackson, our own Supreme Court justice, who said, perpetrating a war of aggression is to commit the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Now, what's the accumulated evil? Torture, kidnapping, shooting civilians. It's all there, right? At one point, some Apache helicopter soldiers say, we have some civilians down there that want to surrender. Mm-hmm. And the lawyer from headquarters says, you can't surrender to a helicopter. Boom, boom. End of civilians. I mean, it's the worst kind of thing. And WikiLeaks has done a great service to our country by exposing that.
but that's not the way that it's portrayed in the media. And, you know, going back to that, you said that this is all about sort of killing the messenger, in this case Julian Assange. But is it a matter that the public is just not very interested in these facts, some of these gruesome, horrific things that you mentioned, or is it the media? I mean, who's to blame here?
Well, you know, there's an old movie.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back. This is Carolyn Jaeger with Dr. Andreas Wesserly. So I would take it that the Germans living in Czechoslovakia at that time, and probably the Hungarians and some of the Slovaks too, all of them, when the Munich Agreement changed things, they were quite happy about that.
Of course, sure. They were viewed as the liberators, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so how was it then for you?
Well, you know, I was a little kid at that time, but in August of 1944, we spent our vacation in Deutsche Probe in Slovakia. And Slovakia, of course, was independent after 1939, beginning in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And then I forgot what day it was, August 31st. Or September 1st, it was right on my 10th birthday. We were going to take the train back to Prague because school was beginning again. And my mother and I and my uncle and son were going back to Pressburg, or Bratislava, which is the capital of Slovakia, and then north from there to Prague. And then all of a sudden we stepped out of the house at, must have been around 5 or 5:30 a.m. and all of a sudden there were these strange partisans with their rifles, and it was really a very paralyzing fear, and they motioned us with their rifles to go back into the house, and a martial law was declared, and even if you open the window you will be shot. And some woman opened the window a few days later, and she was killed. And then a day later, or right after that, my mother went to the city hall in Deutsche Probe to get a permission to take the train back to Prague. And she didn't know any Slovak. You know, most people in those towns didn't speak any Slovak. Slovak spoke our dialect with us.
Okay.
And so, but she knew Czech very well because she had lived in Prague for a number of years. And she went up to the city hall and talked to the leading partisan, whose name was Šovčík. And he was some kind of a semi-communist or communist pan-Slavic teacher from a Slovak village about 7 miles away, or something like that.
So the partisans had taken over, but they were in total control.
Right, they took over everything. They took over all.
Well, what happened to the Wehrmacht already in September 44?
They weren't there. They were in the east of the area.
They never were there. Oh, I see. They weren't there at all because it was just a peaceful area.
That's right. It was peaceful and pacified. And then anyway, my mother talked to the Šovčík. And he said he took her to be a Czech. He thought she was a Czech. And then he said, well, why are you trying to get away? You can stay here. We're going to shoot all the Germans, and then we'll take their property, and you can have part of the property.
Oh, my goodness.
That was our plan, right?
Oh.
And, yeah.
Well, I'm not surprised at that, but it's interesting that your mother was actually a witness to that.
Yeah.
And what did she say? Did she didn't reveal that she was German? She just left?
Well, the thing is, then he said, could I see your ID card, because everybody has to have an ID card now, or a passport. And then she showed her passport, and then showed her last name, Vesele, you know, it was a German name, and one of the cousins of my father's, his name was Tony Vesele, he was some kind of a old amateur archaeologist, and he founded a little museum with all kinds of traditional local culture, you know. So he was definitely a very persona non grata by the Prussian communists and Pan Slavs, including Mr. Shovchik. And he looked at the name and said, Vesele, are you related to that cleric? He also studied theology for a while. Are you related to the cleric Vesele? And she said, no, not personally, but my the husband is one of his cousins. So he didn't say anything after that. He filled out a piece of paper and gave it to her. And then she showed afterwards, she showed a piece of paper to a Slovak from German, from Deutsch Proben, who had lived there, you know, for many decades. And he looked at it and said, don't use that, because this just means at the next train station you'll be arrested and hustled off to a camp somewhere, you know. So we didn't take the train. We did not go back to Prague at that time. And you were not allowed to talk to other people in the street. You couldn't stop and talk to your neighbors because you would be shot. And there were various other such things. And all the radios and everything had to be delivered to the city hall.
Well, what were you allowed to do from that time on?
We were more or less allowed to vegetate on. And, of course, in the back of many of these houses, or most of the houses, there were large orchards. Like my grandparents' and grandmother's house, she had a huge orchard in the back. They might have included, hard to say, maybe 50 trees, apple trees and pear trees, and one huge walnut tree that was about 100 feet tall. And so we more or less lived in those orchards. And once in a while, of course, we had to go shopping, but...
You lived off the fruit.
Yeah.
And how did... You know, now, before I forget, and I know we've said it before, but now, your particular family, how far back do you trace your family on both your parents' side?
Well, on my mother's side, my grandmother was descended from the locatoren. Locatoren is a Latin word, the locators. They were the ones, the pioneers, who planned all these cities and villages.
Okay.
And she can trace them back to the 13th century.
All right. That's what that's very interesting. So right. So you personally have long roots.
Right.
Had deep roots there. Your own
right.
family did. Okay.
Right.
Now, how many in your family, was your father at home at that time?
No, thank God he wasn't there. Otherwise, they would kill him. They killed all the...
Men?
Merchants, all the teachers, everybody except my uncle, who was a priest of the town. His name was Joseph. And it was going step by step, you know, and afterwards they're going to kill all of us. And then apparently towards the end of September, small detachment, the SS, which had been moving up from the capital, from Pressburg and Bratislava, north into our area, very slowly. They heard about the plans to wipe out all of Deutsch Proben, you know, which had already been preceded by various mass murders in various small villages like Glasau, Krikau, and so on.
How did they carry out these mass murders, and did they have mass burials?
is they had them dig their own graves at first, a mass grave, and then they machine gunned them into it. They just plopped into the grave.
Okay, so this is what the communists and the partisans did.
Right.
Who accused the SS of doing that all over.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because when the SS came in, it was a police detachment. They only had two small armored guns at, it was called Sturmgeschütze, at their disposal. And the guns actually had no ammunition. They couldn't shoot they couldn't shoot the cannons. They could only shoot the machine guns. Machine guns to the ammunition. And they moved in, and we all fled, you know, hid in bunkers that we dug out in the orchard. And we heard the machine guns go tack, 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 just a few meters away. And then I ran out of the bunker and looked, and I could see these partisans jumping across the fences. And the fences were all about 5 foot tall. And they jumped across the fences like rabbits. You know, they broke all the Olympic records. It was amazing. They were so afraid that they just jumped across those tall fences and whoop, they would have broken all the Olympic records. They were very good at torturing to death defenseless civilians. But when it came to defending against even a small police detachment, they didn't do it. And they hid in the forest.
Yeah.
The forests are very close, about two, three miles away from there.
So how do they, when you say tortured him to death, and they tortured a lot of these, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, just it's up to your imagination, but then as far as this individual was concerned, his name was Tony Veseli. He was reputed to have been, they had various instruments, you know, like steel rods and stuff like that. And they pushed the steel rod into his stomach.
Were they trying to get information, or were they just trying to?
No, they were just trying to kill him. And
That was their method of killing.
Right. It was sort of like a sword, you know, pushing a sword into somebody's belly. And that's what they did with him.
And then you don't die right away.
No, he didn't die right away. It took some time. And then the others who were sitting about him were captured by the partisans and taken about 10 miles east into the next valley to the headquarters of the partisans near a castle there. They said to each other, well, of course, they were very depressed and all that. And then they saw that they were going to be shot, and they were actually happy about being shot and not being tortured to death.
So then what did this SS detachment do, and how did that?
Well, actually, they were very humane,
at
least according to my relatives, like my mother and my uncles and aunts and so on.
Well, naturally, they would be humane to the Germans, or were they humane to everybody?
Yeah, they were humane to everybody. They even called it partisan. Or at least somebody who was accused of being a partisan, and he was held in the municipal jail in the basement of the city hall. And of course, all of my relatives, especially my mother and my aunts and so on, wanted to lynch him, you know, on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't, and they treated him very well, and they didn't torture him, they didn't beat him up.
They treated him like he was a prisoner of war, huh?
Yeah, it was like a prisoner of war, even though
he was a partisan.
He was not a member of the armed forces. He wasn't wearing a uniform.
Right.
He was a civilian. These partisans were all civilians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So according to the law of war, you can shoot a partisan. If somebody, if a civilian shoots from behind the house or behind the barn, and he's a civilian, you can nab him and shoot him, according to the law of war, unless he wears a uniform, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not wearing a uniform, they could have shot him, but they did not. And in general, they were very humane towards both the Slovaks and the Germans.
There's the Slovakian army, and
right.
then there's these partisans under these, you know,
right.
how, what was the relationship between those two groups?
Well, it was mainly hostile, because the Slovak army, remember at that time, since March of 1939, Slovakia was independent, and
mm-hmm.
It was supposedly an ally of Germany. And some of the
yeah.
Slovaks even fought in the East, fought against the Russians. Probably not too well, but they fought against the Russians.
Yes. Why weren't they able to put down the partisans? Or were they so weak, or were they doing other things, or what?
Well, yeah, they were weak, and they were probably divided, because some of them probably sympathized with the partisans, and others were sympathize with Germany, you know. And
mm-hmm.
they could also see the red steamroller, the Red Army, getting closer and closer towards eastern Poland and eastern Slovakia and so on. And they knew they had to do something to preserve the independence of Slovakia, if possible,
mm-hmm.
so they wouldn't be totally run over by the Red Army, you know.
Yeah, which they were anyway.
Yeah.
So while they were not encouraging the partisans, they were either looking the other way, were they, or were they just not doing anything to stop them, or were they not able to, or what?
I suppose they were not able to stop them, yeah, right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, just as a marginal footnote here, about roughly, say, 250 miles east of Deutsche Probe, east of the Holland, there's a very strategic pass. It's called the Dukla Pass, D-U-K-L-A. And the Red Army was trying to storm them because it was a pass that led from eastern Poland through the Carpathian Mountains in eastern Slovakia into eastern Hungary. Now, if the Red Army had been able to take that pass, they would have been very easily able to race into the plains of Hungary and capture Budapest, and then go north and catch the German front in southern Poland and in Silesia in the back, and then just roll it up like that. So they tried to conquer this Dukla Pass in eastern Slovakia. And this pass was given to the so-called Czechoslovak Legion of the Red Army. However, they were unable to do that. And according to one source, unfortunately I've forgotten the name of the author, but I've seen it, and Bishop Antoni, our former president, showed it to me.
Mm-hmm.
According to this book, despite a small number of German defenders in this mountainous area, about 80,000 Red Army bit the dust. 80,000.
Because the Germans had a superior position there, I guess.
Right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the very small, you know, inferior numbers, they were
mm-hmm.
able to kill a lot of Red Army soldiers.
Yes.
The Czechoslovak Legion.
Yeah.
So they didn't capture the Dukla Pass. If they had done that, they would have, of course, raced up the Neutra River, which runs through a Deutsche Probe, and would have caught us and probably shipped us off to Siberia, you know. The interesting thing is that, strange thing, that the headquarters of the partisans was located about 10-12 miles east of Deutsche Probe in the next valley to the east of Deutsche Probe, in a famous old rich city called Neusol in German. Neusol, it had once been a famous silver mining town, and then in 1495 the German billionaires called the Fugger, F-U-G-G-E-R, had established a mining and commercial cooperation with a local Hungarian nobleman, the Thurzo. This was in 1495, and Neusel, or then became known as Banská Bystrica in Slovak, Banská Bystrica, Bystrica Banja in Hungarian, and Neusel or Banská Bystrica became one of the outstanding rich German cities in that area, in the Hauerland. And they picked the Protestants, picked this town to be the headquarters. It was really strange.
Hmm.
Oh, nearby there was a large castle, and that's where the headquarters was.
For the Protestants.
Yeah. The Protestants, yeah.
And did the SS groups there, troops there, did they go after the Protestants, or did they
They did. They chased them out.
Or what?
The means at the disposal of the SS were really, at that time, very small. They had two long-barreled guns, probably 18-centimeter caliber, and they shot from one of my neighbor's orchards. There were huge orchards. Each orchard had something like 200 or 150 trees in them. And anyway, they had those two guns and placed in that orchard, and they were shooting east over the mountains into this particular castle near Neusel, or near Banská Bystrica.
Okay.
They were shelling the partisan headquarters. And then after that, they stormed the entire area, and the partisans were either killed or fled into the mountains. Oh, by the way, some of their leaders were actually Soviet agents that had been dropped by a parachute.
Oh, I believe that.
Yeah.
Hmm. And how was that found out? I mean, were some of them captured or something? Or?
Yeah, some of them were captured. And very interestingly, in one of these small villages called Glasahal, where the entire male population over the age of 14 and up were killed with machine guns, there were three survivors. There were, I think, 160 dead or something like that. It was a small village.
Mm.
And one of the survivors was the local priest. They were all wounded, and they looked dead. And so then the partisans, you know, went through their pockets and they stole everything they had and wristwatches and all that. But they left them for dead. But actually, this priest was alive, wounded but alive, and he said that the leader of this atrocity in Glasahal was a Soviet officer with a long leather coat. He had a long leather coat on.
Mm.
And he was the leader of those partisans that killed all those men. They also tortured the German soldiers that they caught somewhere in the forest or somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, ambushes.
Did they? They didn't torture them just to get information. They also just
tortured them to have fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
They gouged their eyes out. They cut their nose and ears off.
Now, this is not torture, really. This is extreme atrocities that they carried.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. These people were, like you said, pretty vicious.
Yeah.
And they were the lowest on the lowest level. They're the ones, like you said, they hide and then they come out when everything is green clear and everybody's helpless. And then if somebody comes up against them, they run and hide again.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Jumped across the fence.
Yeah. Well, so when did you leave your town finally for good?
Well, then we left at the end of September. We went back to Prague, and I went to school for a couple of months.
Wow, you stayed in Prague that long.
Right, because my father had a job in Prague. You know, he was the plant manager of a large tannery. And
did the people still think that that it wasn't settled yet, that maybe maybe Prague would still remain safe or what?
Yes, at that time it seemed so, right.
Okay.
Right. And then, of course, with the Russian army, the Red Army coming closer and closer into, say, Romania and Hungary and Eastern Slovakia, and then many of the refugees came north. They fled from the Red Army. And like my, some of my cousins and aunts and uncles came to stay with us in Prague in our apartment.
We'll take a break and return in a few minutes to our special extended show with Dr. Andreas Wesserle.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Priscilla Huff with the latest world news. The death toll in the cholera outbreak in Haiti is nearing 260, but officials think the spread of the disease is slowing. It's the worst outbreak of cholera in Haiti in 50 years, but the director of the health ministry, Gabriel Timothy, says the worst part is over, but you can always get a new spike of cholera. International organizations are stepping up in hopes of quashing the illness, including the Pan American Health Organization. Daniel Epstein is their spokesman.
The Pan American Health Organization is working very closely with the Ministry of Health to help treat cases of cholera, to track the epidemic, and to reduce the effects of severe cholera in people who have already been infected. We also need to work very closely with other UN agencies and non-government organizations to help bring treatment to people who have been affected.
Afghan's President Hamid Karzai explained that, yes, his government does receive cash payments from various friendly governments to defray expenses. In a report in the New York Times, Western diplomats described the cash as essentially a slush fund from Iran's ambassador to Afghanistan, Umar Dowdzai, to help promote Iranian interests. President Karzai described the newspaper report as defamatory and said there is no news about the money changing hands.
This is transparent, and this is something that I have I have also discussed with even when we were at Camp David with President Bush. This is nothing hidden. We are grateful for the Iranian help in this regard. The United States is doing the same thing. They are providing cash to some of our offices.
The rise of the Tea Party during President Obama's first 2 years in office is having a major impact on the U.S. midterm elections. Steve Mort reports from Florida about the rise of the Tea Party.
I believe historians will write that 2010 was an extraordinary election year.
Marco Rubio was little known in Florida until this election, but the 39-year-old has managed to ride a wave of dissatisfaction with Washington and is now the front-runner in the race for U.S. Senate in Florida. Political science professor Aubrey Jewett says candidates like Rubio have appealed to many Tea Party supporters.
The vast majority don't like Obama, and they think the government spending's out of control, and they worry that it's not going to get any better.
Rubio, like many so-called Tea Party candidates, is running as a Republican, having beaten an established Republican in the primaries earlier this year. Other Tea Party-backed candidates pulled off similar upsets. Meanwhile, Tea Party favorite Sarah Palin is reportedly considering a run for president in 2012, banking on the Tea Party movement remaining strong for at least the next 2 years. Steve Mort, Orlando.
Canadian Omar Khadr is set to hear his sentence, the youngest detainee at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He pled guilty to 5 charges of terrorism in a U.S. military court. This is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with my very special guest, Dr. Andreas Wesserle, who is now going to tell us about the events in Prague in April and May 1945. and also his family's escape from there, only to come to more terrible conditions after the war's end. Here's Dr. Wesserle.
Of course, in all the German civilians, at the beginning of 1945, March, April of 1945, were encouraged to leave or told to leave. And so one of my aunts and her children and my grandmother and some other people, they all rented a cattle wagon, you know, it's where you used to ship cows and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the floor of it was covered with straw, which was very nice, clean straw. And they had a stove in there. And they all lived in this cattle wagon for about a week. It took them a week to get to 200 miles from Deutschgruben to Prague. An entire week.
This was a covered wagon.
Yeah, it was covered. They had a roof on it, yeah.
Okay.
In April of 1945, on Palm Sunday of 1945, the American 8th Air Force put on a big bombing raid of eastern Prague, not the downtown, but the eastern section where most of the factories were concentrated, and they just blasted the hell out of those factories. Like my father's factory was hit by 7 direct hits by 2,000-pounders or 1,000-pounders. It was totally demolished. The only thing that survived was our car that was inside of a concrete garage. Apparently, they did that so that they also carried out air raids against other big industrial cities in Bohemia and Moravia, like Pilsen, you know, that famous Škoda works, and Brno,
mm-hmm.
where all the big industries were concentrated, and they demolished them totally, probably to keep them out of the hands of the Russians, which was rather foolish, because to begin with, Roosevelt had done everything in his power to support Stalin and his rule, and he had donated billions and billions of dollars worth of food and of military equipment to the Red Army, without which the Red Army would have been beaten.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, close to the time when Roosevelt died, then somebody in the American government, possibly Stettinius, who was in the Secretary of State, who was close to many people on Wall Street, or someone other, some high up in Washington, ordered these air raids to take place and to demolish all these big industrial establishments, factories and machine works and so on, so that the Russians couldn't get them. By that time it was too late, and it was kind of foolish. Also killed a lot of people.
Yeah, well, where are these people counted? And these people are counted as war deaths, usually blamed on the Germans when it was actually the Allied bombs that killed them, right?
That's exactly true. Uh-huh. But in a way, there was a blessing because my aunt, who had fled Deutschgruben and lived in our apartment in Prague, was afraid there would be another air raid. So she insisted on fleeing Prague. And at the end of April, was it April 22nd, around that time, and then my father, being a plant manager of that big factory, got a truck. But, of course, the truck didn't run on diesel or on gasoline because it was all taken over by the army and by the armed forces. But it ran on wood gas.
Yeah.
You had to throw a lot of wood into a big pot that was on top of the truck. And then the gas, it was developed by this wood stove.
Is this what was called producer gas?
I suppose. I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
So anyway, this wood gas propelled truck then took us, at the end of April, took us from Prague to the Sudetenland, about 100 meters very close to the border of Bavaria, to the German area. And
did you have all your relatives and everything in that truck and all your goods?
All my relatives, my grandmother, my aunt, all of my cousins, well, most of my cousins, my uncle, two uncles, matter of fact, one of them was a priest. This was the end of April, and we went southwest of Prague towards the Bavarian border. But then on May 4th, the Czech leaders decided to have a revolt, and it turned out to be extremely vicious and bloody. And the Red Army was getting closer and closer, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, General Patton, the U.S. general, who was probably most gung-ho to push forward, push east into Bohemia, was not allowed to do that by General Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander. And they were just able to go into a few cities like Pilsen in mm-hmm. western Bohemia and some of the border areas between Bavaria and Bohemia. And they were not allowed to push east to try to stop the Red Army, you know, which they could have done. But they didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Oh, yeah, getting back to the events in Prague, one thing led to another, and at one time there was even part of the Vlasov army. The Vlasov was the Soviet general who deserted to the German side, offered to fight communism, fight Stalin. But unfortunately he was distrusted by Hitler and some of the other advisors.
And you think that was a mistake? You think he should have been
shot? Yes, it was a mistake. It definitely was a mistake, right.
Okay.
Because there was, at least most of those Russians would have been, or Ukrainians and other people, would have been very anxious to fight against Stalin. Of course, after that, there would have been a problem of what to do with Russia, even communist or not communist, you know. But on top of that, there were also large detachments of Cossacks, Ukrainian Cossacks and so on, who mm-hmm. went over to the German side to fight Stalin and fight the Russians, because they didn't really regard themselves as true Russians, but as Ukrainians. And they really did a lot of very heroic work and heroic resistance against the Red Army, the Cossacks did.
Yeah, they have a very good reputation, and they were really punished afterwards too when they were captured.
Yeah, right. There was a detachment of Cossacks in this village in Bavaria where we stayed, called Neukirchen, mm-hmm. by Heiligenblut. I can still remember them. And at the outskirts of this village, the Americans or somebody had built kind of a, not a real stadium, but an oval race course, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because many of these American officers were Pattonites, and they had horses, and they're galloping around on the horses, and they more or less sympathized with the Cossacks, and there was a bunch of Cossacks there, I still remember, and they were short, all of them were short compared to the Americans.
Okay.
They had their colorful uniforms, you know, and the fur caps and boots and everything. So they displayed their riding skills in front of the American officers. They were galloping around this oval, jumping off the horse and jumping on the horse in full gallop, which not too many people can do, yeah, but these Cossacks did it.
Uh-huh.
And then one day they were missing, and we didn't know what the hell happened. And they'd all been shipped across the border into Bohemia, which was now in Czech control, and they were all hanged.
Well, this was the fate of the Cossacks. And who was responsible for that? Was that because they had to go along with Stalin's demands that these people be returned to him?
Well, no, they didn't have to. It's just the British and the Americans voluntarily, knowing that all these people would be killed or possibly tortured to death, you know, turned them over to the Red Army.
Yeah, so they were American prisoners, these Cossacks.
Exactly.
They were prisoners of war, and that's what I mean. Yeah, and so the Americans did that, as well as the British also turned Cossacks that had made it to Austria. They turned them back to Tito.
And they
were really after these Cossacks. They really treated them awful.
That's right.
It's a horrible, horrible thing. These were some of the bravest men, and they were very anti-communist.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm. All right, so you saw that. Now,
well, let me say a few words about this revolt in Prague. It was extremely inhuman, you know, and civilians were stuffed into subterranean movie theaters, because in downtown Prague, like in downtown Vienna, most movie theaters are below ground. And so they use these for prisons. And according to a friend of my father's, who was a fraternity brother of my father's, actually an old boy network, and he got my father a job in 1932 or thereabouts, 1931. And this particular gentleman was Jewish, but he lived in a large villa in one of the best parts of Prague, and he was the director of IG Farben, a director of the chemical works, the chemical
company. Yeah, well, we call IG Farben, so everybody knows.
Right, yeah. Right. Anyway, he, despite being a Jew, he and his entire family was also incarcerated, all the other Germans, and he said that every day they were lined up in the back court of that movie theater, and every 10th person was shot, and that entire court was just covered with blood with all the people that had been shot. And then a few days later, they were driven towards the Moldau River and pelted with stones, you know, the whatchamacallit, the pavement stones. And two of his fingers were broken because he protected his head from being bashed in with the pavement stone. And then they got to the Moldau River, and many people were plunged into the Moldau River, including, he said, a young mother with two children. The children were tied around her body, and they were all thrown into the river, and they all drowned.
I heard about that, throwing people in the river, or that may have been another place. I'm thinking of another place in Czechoslovakia.
There were many, yeah, that's right.
In Czech, yeah, where they people were drowned in the river, they threw them in.
Right.
And they've never been recovered either. They're still down there.
In the Elbe River.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went back there.
So they just decided they'd line everybody up, and then they shot every 10th person so that everybody was scared to death and
right.
peeing in their pants and stuff, and then they think that's funny, I guess.
And on the main boulevard in Prague, in St. Wenceslas Square, Václavské náměstí, people were burnt alive. You know, they were doused with gasoline or some other kind of flammable fluid, and they were burnt alive on the lampposts.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, how many did they do that to?
Well, there's no true
known
estimate. Several hundred, you know.
And many people they burned.
It didn't just happen in Prague; it also happened in other large cities, where people were burned alive. And the main reason for that was that the year 1420, there was the famous Czech professor and reformer, Jan Hus, at the University of Prague. And, of course, Prague University was really the first modern German university in 1348.
Well, isn't it true that Prague was mostly built by Germans? I mean,
yes. Yes,
I mean, the whole culture of Prague was German.
German still
and
is.
Prague is a fantastic place.
Starting with St. Vith's Cathedral and all the palaces and mansions and fortifications and all that. It was all built either by Germans or for Germans. That's right. And what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So in 1420, this Professor Hus was invited to the Council of Constance in 1420, which had been called by Emperor Sigismund to fight against the Pope because the Popes were getting more and more autocratic. And Sigismund wanted to have a church government by council, as it had been true in the past, but he failed. Anyway, so Hus was invited to go to Constance, on Lake Constance. And very foolishly, he followed the invitation, and they promised not to touch him, you know, not to do any harm to him. And once there, he was condemned as a heretic and burned at the stake, which is definitely not very Christian. And then his followers unleashed a very bloody war, the Hussite Wars, against Bavaria, against Saxony, and against Hungary, and all sides of Bohemia. And but anyway, so this was the main reason.
So that's why then they, boy, that's
the main reasons they put them, they tied them to these lampposts
to get revenge for that one man,
for that one, the famous reformer in 1420. Yeah.
And this was all religious. I mean, that was all religious war going on.
Right
back then. It wasn't racial.
No, it was religious, totally.
Yeah. Well, you know, then there's that film that's come out about Prague, Murder Czech Style or something, and it's got all this footage from when they were shooting Germans in Prague, and it has that one scene where they were running over the bodies with a big truck or something.
Tank.
Yeah, it's a tank of some kind. Looked like a truck to me, but maybe it was a tank. And
let me say another thing, Carolyn.
Okay.
A few years ago, maybe 8 years ago, something like that, I watched PBS Public Broadcasting Service quite regularly because of their really outstanding nature and cultural films, you know. But politically, they're really way off for a very good reason.
Yeah. They've gotten worse over time.
Right. And so they showed these charred cadavers. And they said, oh, this is St. Wenceslas Square in Prague, and these are the charred bodies of Jews who were burned by the Nazis.
Okay.
That's what they said. Yeah, typically.
And this is what you were just telling us, is the Germans who were burned by the Czechs.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to talk about this sometime because we've got so much film and so many pictures and things being spread around and being mislabeled absolutely and knowingly lies saying this is what the Germans did, this is what the Nazis did, and a whole lot of it. And what I've researched and looked at so far, the Nazis did not commit atrocities. Not that they didn't execute people. But they weren't out trying to stick hot pokers in people's stomachs and things like that.
Right. It was just the other way around. A few years ago, there was one of those many so-called eyewitness movies on television. And they showed old ladies being chased to their death into a huge mass grave, and they're being machine gunned into the grave.
Really?
Actually, you could tell by their dress that they were Germans. These were German ladies and civilians that were being machine gunned into the mass grave somewhere in Eastern Europe. The commentary on TV said that they were, God knows what, you know, some other population. Poles or Ukrainians or somebody. It wasn't, they weren't actually German civilians who were. Oh, yeah, but then in 1945, when the Red Army finally conquered Deutsch Poland and the Holland and in Slovakia, they also perpetrated all kinds of atrocities. For instance, first buildings on the south side of Deutsch Poland was an inn. And the inn was run by two semi-retarded brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, they were intelligent enough to sell beer and shops and stuff like that, you know, but they were not totally rational. And so these two brothers who were middle-aged, I don't know, around 40 years old, something like that, when the Red Army came in, they grabbed their size, you know, the stuff they used to cut the corn with and stuff like that.
Oh, scythes or scythes, yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, those curved, sharp, big things that
right.
Cut.
And right, they rushed out and tried to to defend their home, you know, against the Red Army. Yeah, it was really very unfortunate. And the Russians doused them with gasoline and burned them alive. Yeah, so it was definitely an atrocity. And they also, they raped all the women they got, including an old lady that lived across from my grandmother. My grandmother, thank God, had left. She was about 82 years old, and she was gang raped by a bunch of Russians. And she died of so-called Siberian gonorrhea, which is probably not from Siberia, but the Russians had got it someplace in some house of repute in Romania, you know. Mm-hmm. And then my uncle, Joseph Petru, was the chief priest, not just of that town, but the entire valley. He was sort of the supervisor of one town and 10 villages. And they took him and his housekeeper to the edge of town, and then they clapped a pistol to his head, and they forced him to watch as 17 Russians were raping his housekeeper. It took 2 hours. And then, of course, my uncle having living in a large rectory, it was really a huge building next to the main church. He had a study up on the second floor, which included a harmonium, you know, a small organ which he played, and there is a Dresden china, the Meissen china, and the Russians went in and they threw everything out the window. they rolled themselves in their greatcoats, their long coats, and slept in the middle of the room, and they went to the bathroom in the corner of the room, you know. The corners were used as toilets, and they slept in the middle of the room. It was a large room, maybe 30 feet by 20 feet or something like that, was my uncle's study. But anyway, they lived in the middle of the room, and they used the corners of that room as toilets for weeks and weeks.
And were there toilets available? I mean, I think sometimes there were facilities, and they didn't even use them.
They didn't use them. There were WCs, you know, flush toilets.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because this was one of the few buildings in all the entire town that was equipped with them, but they didn't know what to do with it.
And they didn't even learn. I mean, I've read that at Auschwitz, when they got there, you know, there were flush toilets in the dormitories at Auschwitz, and there were flush toilets in the kitchens. And they were washing their hands in there. They didn't know what they were for.
Oh, they washed the potatoes and stuff like that.
Okay.
That's what they did.
Wash the potatoes.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, Reason Radio Network. www.thedeathtollnetwork.com.
The United States has waged well-known wars in Afghanistan,
300 meters,
and in Iraq. But some argue it's also waging a lesser-known battle.
The United States is leading a financial world war to obtain foreign resources and essentially to make other economies pay tribute to it.
In this war, U.S. dollars are the bullets, and they're cheap ammunition because the U.S. Federal Reserve has been printing and pumping a lot of them into the economy.
The Federal Reserve had a balance sheet of about $850 billion, and that shot up to $2.1 trillion.
More than $1.5 trillion spent buying bonds and home mortgages from banks in the last 2 years to try to prop up the U.S. economy. This policy is called quantitative easing. It lowers interest rates and gives banks more cash to lend. Now, it hasn't exactly helped the average American, but here's where it does matter.
If the United States sets interest rates very low and tries to open up large routes to lending, then American corporations and American investors take money, borrow money, and then they go all over the world and buy things.
The money leaves the U.S. because low interest rates mean investors aren't getting much return on assets at home.
This puts inflationary pressure on other countries. And you've seen Brazil react to that. You've seen China react to that. You've seen South Korea react to that.
So, why does this matter for you? Why should you care? Well, let's talk about the things speculators or investors like to buy. Things like soft commodities. Wheat, sugar, soybeans. Those affect your food prices. I'll take these. So if investors pour lots of money into soft commodities, that means global food prices, your food prices, go up, like happened in 2007 and 2008. Speculators also like oil. But if they all put their money into oil, the price of energy for most of the world that consumes it goes up too. And when you, the U.S., are acting like an ATM for the world, pumping cash into the economy, trillions of dollars, this is the scenario you're helping to create. And pushing down the value of the U.S. dollar, the international reserve currency, while pushing up the value of other currencies. It's prompted an outcry from countries like Brazil, essentially complaining about the U.S.
using beggar thy neighbor policies, which are ultimately stealing from our economies.
And we've seen countries taking steps to protect their currencies and their exports from getting more expensive.
We believe it's very important.
Meanwhile, U.S. policymakers have rattled their sabers at the IMF and the G20 meetings, calling for countries to let their currencies rise, but with no mention of the declining dollar.
There's no doubt in my mind that the leaders of this country, who think very much in terms of power and even empire, they want to keep it that way.
But as the U.S. appears poised to fire off a new round of quantitative easing, the rest of the world is fighting back.
Instead of having this multipolar world led by the IMF and the World Trade Organization with a very heavy influence for the U.S. government and the United States Treasury, we're seeing lots of governments going around the world cutting two-party deals.
Cutting deals to trade not in the reserve currency, but in local currencies, fighting back against the U.S.'s financial world war that in the end may prove a losing battle. Lauren Lister, RT, New York.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back. This is the final segment of our special two-hour show tonight with Dr. Andres Wesserle.
All right, so
you got to, you were very close to Austria now. It's a good thing you left, huh? Your aunt did everybody a favor.
Close to that area. This was in the Bohemian Forest, you know, that divides Bohemia on one hand from Austria and Bavaria to the south. We were only by there, as I said, about 100 meters away from the border. Then we stayed there on that large farm for a number of weeks. And then after those weeks...
And what kind of a farm was this? Was this German, a German
it was
farm?
It was a German farm. It was a large farm for that area. I think
and they let you... Okay.
40 hectares. Either 40 or 80 hectares, which make it huge because it was in a mountainous area.
Mm-hmm.
40 okay. hectares would be 100 acres.
And did they? How did you eat? Did they feed you? Were they take?
Yeah, we paid them.
People there taking South care of everyone. Hmm?
Yeah, my parents paid them. I suppose I didn't worry okay. about that.
Yeah.
No, about a few miles away, there was an American battery of 155 millimeter howitzers, and they shelled us. Yeah, there was no resistance there whatsoever. There were no German soldiers. Nothing, but I think they had a big pile of ammunition and they didn't know what to do with it and just shot it away. This was at the end. Yeah, this was at the end of the Second World War. This was maybe in May of 1945.
Well, I'll tell you, at that time, it's my opinion from all the things I've been reading and studying, that they were getting very trigger happy and they were just shooting and killing everything around, weren't they?
Yeah, they also had a little airplane, a Piper Cub. You know, one of those little single-engine planes. Mm-hmm. And it flew very low, about, at the most, 1,000 feet above the ground, maybe 500 feet. We could see their heads. We could see the head of the pilot. There were two mm-hmm. guys in the plane. And then my cousin and I waved to them. And just the very act of waving to them made them mad or something. And they blasted us with another round of howitzers.
Yeah.
Yeah. They couldn't see that we were kids, you know, but they were so...
Well, they were supposed to just shoot everything that moved. So
exactly.
If you raised your hand, you were something was moving, so they aim and they shoot. That's how they were behaving. And
yeah,
so what did it make you think as a 10-year-old and your cousins and so on? What did you think of these Americans?
Well, we were afraid most of it, you know.
Because you were afraid of the Russians, so it made you think better of the Americans. But you know, were you confused by this?
We did think better of the Americans, but we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And some of the shells also landed in the church of the closest town, called Neuen. This must have been either a Saturday afternoon or Sunday, and there was just a. They were praying a litany, so there were a whole bunch of people that were killed in that church. Maybe, I don't know, 14, 15, 16 of them were killed. And then the Americans came around on their jeeps, but these were armor jeeps. They had an iron plate in front of the windshield, and they had a kind of a steel stick. On the bumper, if it was a bumper. Anyway, they had a vertical steel rod in front of the engine, which was supposed to keep any steel ropes that somebody might string from tree to tree, and then these Americans would come barreling around on their jeeps and might cut their heads off, see? So they had this... of course, nobody did that, but they...
They were prepared for that.
They were prepared for the worst. And they had this steel vertical rod on the front of the Jeep. And then they had this armor plate in front of the windshield with two little vision slits so they could peer through those little slits.
Uh-huh.
And on the back seat, they had a guy with a 50 caliber machine gun. And his... fingers were on the trigger. See, anything they moved, they mowed down, you know.
Yeah.
And so...
Put a lot of fear into the people so they wouldn't...
Yeah, we're pretty terrorized.
Mm-hmm.
But then they came along, and I still remember I said to... they were sitting inside the Jeep, and I took my fist and then went bang against this armored plate that was in front of the windshield. And mm-hmm. said, Panzerfaust, geht durch. Panzerfaust was the German bazooka, you know. I said to the American soldiers, I said, German bazooka will go through this
steel
plate. I took my fist, you know, and went against the bang like that, against the armor plate.
Wow, that was really brave of you.
Then one of the American soldiers turned around and he said, "No, Panzerfaust, boom!" And he made as if the Panzerfaust was too weak to go through that armor plate, you know, it would be deflected upwards. That's what that was his reply. Yeah. It was really funny.
Yeah, so you were talking with the American soldiers there.
Right.
Okay, and so what was your relationship then? How did that develop? Did you, how did everything develop with the Americans? You were in an American zone, I guess, or what?
Well, then we, this, remember this was still in the Sudetenland.
Yeah.
And that was then re-annexed by the new state of Czechoslovakia, which had just been proclaimed by Beneš in May of 1945, including expulsion of the Germans and the Hungarians. So we quickly went across the border, which was only 100 meters away, which was very good. So we went downhill to the next large village, which is called Neukirchen, which used to be a famous Marian pilgrimage place. And, well, it was just absolute chaos in there. But the interesting thing was that one of my uncles was a priest, and it so happened that the American commanding officer of that village, his name might have been O'Connor, I'm not totally sure, he was Irish. So he was Irish Catholic. So my father and my other uncle and my priest uncle went to see the Bavarian priest of that town. And very luckily, this particular priest, his name was Kurtenthal, was a very fine Christian. One of the very few, by the way. And he helped everybody that he could. So he employed, my uncle who was a priest, he employed him as a chaplain. And then he also talked, all of them talked with Captain O'Connor, or whatever his rank was. And they allowed us, the Americans allowed us to occupy a single room in a, what had been kind of a resort hotel. But all the hotels and all the inns in that town had been confiscated by the Americans, you know. But all then right. The hotel, or so-called hotel that we lived in, it had three floors, was sort of U-shaped. And the outlying wings of the U were given over to various people, like the girlfriends of the American soldiers. They were always pampered, you know.
Oh, who were the girlfriends of the American soldiers?
German,
were they German?
German women, right. Right. Three Blitzmädchen. Blitzmädchen were the ones who were the telephone girls in the Wehrmacht. And, of course, being telephone girls, they probably also had some previous experience. Anyway, the three of them were right next to us in the next room. And they every night they had big parties with the American soldiers. A lot of noise. And then we squeezed into this one room, which before...
Yeah, how many of you were in that room?
Nine.
Nine of you in a room. That
nine
was
of us. The room was approximately 8 foot wide. 8 foot. And maybe, I don't know.
Did you have a bathroom there?
No. 14, 15 feet long. So nine of us squeezed into this tiny room, which had been the chamber of the maid. It was the maid's chamber.
Okay.
And so... the maid had been made pregnant by the landlord. And so I guess she went back to her village. So we got that particular room. But then... My aunt and my mother and my cousin, who was a teenager, had to clean the rooms, you know, whatchamacallit.
Oh.
Cleaning ladies for the American soldiers.
Do you think you would have been better off outdoors or than in that room working for the...
For that one room. Yeah.
There's
no bathroom, no running water, nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
But this particular village used to have a population of about 4,000. But then after March and April and May of 1945, there were 20,000 refugees on top of those 4,000. And most of those 20,000 lived outdoors for months and months and months until they died, you know.
And this is elderly people and children. I know I've seen these pictures of refugees from the East.
Babies, at that time there were only children.
Lots of babies died. Lots and lots of babies died. And they wanted them to die because they wanted to reduce the German population.
Exactly. There was a Morgenthau plan.
Yeah. So there you were in Bavaria, and you were in this, just across the border, huh? And and you're in this terrible situation now in Germany with all the refugees. And so how long did that last?
Well, that lasted until 1946.
Well, what did you eat while you were during that time before they left, say, while you were in that room? Who was feeding you?
Very little. We ate very little. We had those rationing cards, you know.
But the Americans were supposedly providing food for the people there, or what?
No, they were not. According to JCS, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Directive 1061, I believe, 1067, which was published late in October of 1945, there was supposed to be no so-called fraternization between the Americans and the German population.
Mm-hmm.
No help for the German population whatsoever.
Right.
And only in the case that the epidemics, you know, people would die by the millions, and if that became dangerous to the American troops, then the Americans were supposed to go in there and help them a little bit.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. It was Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive 1067, which was an outflow of the Morgenthau Plan. Morgenthau being a very good friend of Frankie Roosevelt, you know.
Yeah. So where did the food come from?
From nowhere. Really.
Scrounging?
There was a little bit, like every, maybe twice a month, we got some magermilch. What's the magermilch? Skim milk. But it really wasn't skim milk either. It was blue water. We call it blue water because the peasants had been forced to sell or whatever, donate some of the milk to this dairy. And the peasants, of course, added water to it. Then when we got to the dairy, they added water, some more water. And then it was labeled.
Yeah, well, I know if they take out all the fat of the milk, then it's kind of a bluish. Yeah.
Yeah, and but they also added water.
They added water. My God, yeah.
In addition to being skim milk, it was watered down skim milk.
But and you got that only like twice a month or something.
Twice a month, if you were lucky, and you had to stand in line for maybe 12 hours.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I had to stand in line like my father and my uncle stood in line at 10 p.m. at night or even before that, 8, 9 p.m. all night through. Then we kids would get there at, say, 7 o'clock in the morning, and we stand in line until 10:30 or 11 o'clock a.m., then the dairy would open. Everybody rushed in. There were hundreds of thousands of people waiting for a single quart.
Well, they didn't just rush in and get. I mean, did you have to wait until you were given some, or how did you just rush in?
No, we all rushed in. The strongest ones were in there first.
Oh.
It was do or die, you know. So that was our milk. And,
so you had to fight your own fellow people to get your chair.
Exactly, yes, right.
And they say it was only the Germans who made the people in the camps behave like that, which they didn't, because that's not the way they did it there. But
that's right,
this is the way they did it. Yeah.
Right. And let's see, what else was that? Oh, yeah. And the first floor of this hotel where we stayed had been a bowling alley. And the bowling alley was rebuilt by German prisoners of war, into a theater, movie theater for the American soldiers, you know. So when they came out of the movies, and sometimes also, what's his name, the guy with the strange nose from Hollywood, he went from era to entertain the troops.
And oh, this Bob Hope.
Bob Hope.
Oh, Bob Hope.
Bob Hope.
Ski Nose, yeah. Okay, Bob Hope was actually there in person entertaining?
I think so. I didn't know Bob Hope at that time, but there was a big, fat American, and he walked up on the stage from the side door, and I was standing next to the side door begging food, and he gave me a nice pat on my head. I still remember that. He was big and fat, and he looked like Bob Hope. I don't know whether it was Bob Hope.
Well, it could have been someone else, because I don't know that Bob Hope was big and fat.
Well, but they all looked big and fat to me, because...
Yeah, they might have looked that way. You guys were getting starving. Dinner, yeah. Yeah.
And anyway, when the American soldiers came out of the movie...
And he patted you on the head.
Yeah, he patted me. Very nice, you know, kind of...
That's all. He didn't give you anything.
No, he didn't give me anything. But then when the soldiers came out, they would all smoke cigarettes, and then they'd throw the cigarette butts away, you know, on the floor, on the ground, mm-hmm. in the courtyard. And the wee kids, there were about 14, 15, 16 kids there, we all rushed forward and grabbed this cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Then we tear open the cigarette, discard the paper, and get the tobacco into a tin, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when the tin was full of tobacco, we went out to the peasants and we exchanged this American tobacco for bread or for butter or stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
at the peasants, because the peasants didn't give us anything, you know.
Oh, jeez. They probably figured they didn't have that much for themselves, so they couldn't handle all that big flood of refugees.
Yeah, right.
It was a terrible time. Everybody was trying to survive.
20,000 refugees, right?
Trying
to survive. No police, nothing. But anyway, also this priest in this village, his name was Krotenthaler, he also gave us some food. Once he came in with his altar server, you know, called Ministrant in German. It was raining cats and dogs, and he brought in either it was 50 pounds or 100 pounds of potatoes from some peasants, you know. And we survived on those 50 or 100 pounds of potatoes. And then in fall of 1945...
And were you able to cook? I mean, was there some... Did they cook? Did your mother and the women cook any potatoes, or how did you eat those?
Yeah, we cooked them, right, because my father had brought a portable stove from Prague, and I still remember the American soldiers coming in into our second room. By that time, there was a table there. They come in and put their feet on the table, you know.
What did they come in for?
I don't know, just to say hello. Oh, my cousin was very good looking, and she was 17, so they wanted to get into her good graces, you know.
Yeah.
But, even though all of them were married, they're all married, even the ones that were about 19 or 20 years old, because at that time they all got married right after high school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They graduate from high school and they get married and they get drafted.
Yeah.
So or they get drafted first and they get married.
Anyway, yeah.
So they came in and they put their feet on the table. And we had to tell them to take their feet down. So, yeah, but then anyway...
And then would they do that? See, they had no manners, so arrogant. I mean, I've read that so many German officers said that the Americans, one thing that struck out at them, they all repeat this, that they were so arrogant.
Well, yeah, they were arrogant because they were the victors, you know. Their word was law. There was no police.
Yeah.
Whatever they said had to be done.
So, yeah, but do you think they put their feet up on the table... On your table, in your little abode, that was the only table you had, you think they put their feet up there to kind of show off, or just because they just didn't even know any better, or what?
Oh, no, they want to show off.
Okay.
And the language they used was just blistering, you know. I don't want to repeat it over the phone.
Oh, no.
Oh, it was really dirty language.
Oh, and they and with the women and everything, and they would talk like that?
That's right.
Oh, I never heard that. That's
yeah,
really...
Yeah, very, very dirty language. The F word, every other word was the F word.
F word already then, in 1946 and so. I didn't know they used that word all the time back then.
In the army they did.
Oh no! And they were coming to meet you. They wanted to get in your cousin's good graces, and they talked like that.
Right.
Oh. And did you see black soldiers where you were?
I only saw a single one, and he was unloading a truck.
Okay.
There were no black soldiers. They were used only for menial purposes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But I remember the names of three really nice GIs. One was Douglas from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in the garage of our hotel. It was a huge garage. It had probably been built to accommodate tourist buses, you know, in peacetime. And there was a gallery in the back. And he slept in the gallery. And he was sort of a garage mechanic. And he and some other mechanics repaired tanks and scout cars, armored scout cars and trucks and stuff like that. So that's what I did. And his name was Douglas from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was Harold from New York. And one of the sergeants, his name was Skippy. We didn't know his real name, but everybody called him Skippy. So we all called him Skippy. He was rough and tough, but he had a heart of gold. So he, once in a while, he would sneak us some bread, maybe some oranges, very few times, some bread, and Coca-Cola. I got to drink Coca-Cola in those days.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Not very healthy.
Douglas and Harold and Skippy, those were really three very nice guys. And then the people... You know, the people who remained at home in Deutsch-Prohm and the neighboring towns were then all squeezed together in a concentration camp about, I don't know exactly, say 11 miles south of Deutsch-Prohm called Novaki. And that's where they stayed for a number of months. And most of them were then expelled, that is, the survivors, because the food was rotten, and including one of my aunts and her son, my cousin.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Carolyn Yeager. Let me close this special program with some statistics. According to researcher writer Paul Broetz, by April 45, there still were 21,000 Carpathian Germans living in Slovakia. After the fighting had ceased, perhaps 40,000 who had left returned to their homeland, which truly was their homeland with all that that means, thinking they were innocent of any crimes and had no reason for anxiety. But stripped of all civil rights by the Beneš decrees, these approximate 61,000 were interned and many died, usually of willful neglect from starvation and disease, in camps such as Novaki near Prievidza or in massacres. Others were carried off as slave laborers to the Soviet Union and died there. By 1949, it was estimated that probably 23,000 Carpathian Germans were killed during and after the war. This means a blood toll of 16%, or every sixth Carpathian German. And this is one of the smaller German communities of Eastern Europe. Yet there are no monuments to these innocent victims of war and hatred, or if there are, they are very small, few and far between, are virtually unknown, and get no attention from the world media. Only a handful of ethnic German groups struggle to recognize this Holocaust. Dr. Westerle will be back on the Heretics Hour in the future to share fascinating insights into history that you won't want to miss. Thank you for listening each week, and do your part to spread the voice of reason. Good night for now.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.